Welcome to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're so pleased to have you here with us. Today, we're continuing our new series, The Takeaway Deep Dive. And once again, we're joined by my friend and colleague, Dorian Warren. Now, just as a reminder, Dorian is the co-president of Community Change, the co-chair of the Economic Security Project, and he and I have co-hosted multiple media projects over the years. Welcome back, Dorian.
Hey, Melissa. It's so glad to be back on The Takeaway, and I'm super excited about today because we're going to be taking a very personal deep dive.
Dorian, personal? Because wait a minute, we have known each other 20 years, so just how personal is this deep dive going to get?
Listen, don't worry, Melissa. We are going to talk policy, but this is not abstract, you know, DC insider policy. We're not going to have that conversation. We are going to tackle a real life, day-to-day, on-the-ground issue, and that is childcare and early learning.
Right now, Democrats in Congress are wrestling with the big budget reconciliation, or the human infrastructure bill. And one centerpiece is childcare. But at the same time that childcare is big policy, it's also just deeply personal. I mean, Dorian, that became so obvious just a few moments into our conversation with one of our guests, Akilah Montekin. I feel like we have another guest with us. Can you introduce our other little person?
Yes, this is my 1.5-year-old daughter. Her name is Naima.
So that is, of course, Akilah Montekin. She's the deputy director of Mothering Justice. Now, Mothering Justice is a Detroit-based, BIPOC-led, nonprofit, grassroots, and advocacy organization that develops political and policy leadership with mothers. And as you know, during our conversation with Akilah, she was definitely a living demonstration of the multiple challenges facing working moms. I mean, she was literally balancing a baby on the Zoom while talking with us.
She is my glorified office assistant. and she really enjoys the using Zoom. So she loves being in the office with me.
Yeah, but listen, this was so familiar to me because, as you know, I became a dad for the first time just a year ago. And, you know, I got to say, being a parent in the midst of a global pandemic is no joke. I mean, I've spent an entire year conducting meetings with my little daughter perched on my knee, or she's crawling over me, or of course, she's always pushing the wrong buttons on my computer in the midst of a Zoom meeting. And, you know, to say the least, it's been an adventure. But of course, I have to say this, it's been work. It's been labor because parenting is work.
Look, the idea that there is any such thing as a non-working parent, that's just not true, right? All parents are working. It's really just a question of whether you are being paid for your labor or not. And look, as you know, because you knew me at the beginning of my time as, you know, first pregnant with my first child, here I am, the mom of a college sophomore. I've got a second grader. All of my baby bouncing days hopefully are done. But I did spend a lot of years as a single parent. And I remember solo parenting as an assistant professor. I was trying to get tenure. I was working so hard to take this PhD I'd earned and turn it into a career. I mean, writing and teaching and traveling and figuring out childcare was always the first and a lot of times the hardest task. And I have to say, I thought about those years during our conversation with Akilah.
I would love to send Naima somewhere. It's been a challenge trying to figure things out now that the world is opening back up somewhat. Childcare presents a unique set of obstacles for a lot of families, including my own.
The unique challenges of childcare are not easily navigated by families trying to do it all by themselves. I mean, childcare is not just their problem, it's our problem.
We absolutely 100% need an investment, a large investment in childcare from our government. I think that as we are somewhat exiting the height of the pandemic, folks are saying, hey, why won't people go back to work? Is it the low minimum wage? Most likely, yes. Is it because they're lazy? Absolutely not. People want to work. But I think what the big piece that's missing is that folks don't have access to affordable, quality childcare options, not just for children who are under the age of 5, but also their school age children.
It's such a good point. Affordable childcare is a chronically undermet need in our country. And the pandemic exposed the inequities in childcare in the same way that it laid bare so many inequalities that have for a long time just been operating right below the surface of our systems.
I live in Macomb, Michigan, so I'm a part of the Chippewa Valley School District. And school-aged childcare is about $4.75 per hour per child. That might sound like a low amount, but for some families that have multiple children like mine, we have 3 that are currently in the program, and it's usually about $140 a week. And that's only with them going after school for a couple hours. So I could only imagine for families who needed to send their children early in the morning, that need to send them in the evening as well, they pay even more. And then when you think about the $450 billion that's on the line right now, that money we absolutely needed to go to childcare, because we need not only the investment in our centers and home-based childcare options, but we need it for families so that they can have more access to government funding, so that we can continue to increase the threshold limits for income for families. Because I think that the one thing I dislike most about government assistance is that you have to be like really, really destitute to qualify for benefits. And even if you made $50,000 a year, childcare for an infant usually is about $1,000 or more a month. And that is a huge chunk of someone's income. And it's causing not just a lot of women to leave the workforce, but women, men, and even other family members who are just trying to find ways to help support one another and support the children who need it.
Okay, Melissa. So Akilah really set out the big picture here about childcare affordability. And let's get a little policy nerdy here and dig into some numbers. So I want to be really clear right here. Childcare was staggeringly expensive well before the pandemic began. And we can look at research reported in 2019, which showed that low-income families spent more than a third of their income on childcare, a third of their income on childcare. Now, remember, we define any family who spends more than a third of their income on rent as being in serious danger of becoming homeless. Yet low-income families routinely spend that much on childcare. And the cost of childcare is not just a problem for low-income families. I mean, even families who earn middle-class salaries struggle to afford it. Melissa, you live in North Carolina.
It's true. And I live not just in North Carolina, but in Winston-Salem, which is like got a pretty good cost of living. In part, we choose to be here because you can truly be middle class on a sort of normal person's salary.
Okay. Well, you know, the cost of living might be good on some things, but according to the Economic Policy Institute, the average annual cost of infant care in North Carolina, in your state, is about $9,500 a year. Now, that's $790 a month. Compare that, Melissa, to the cost of tuition to attend a state university in North Carolina, which is only $7,400 a month.
What?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. $9,500 versus $7,400 for in-state tuition. A year of infant care in North Carolina, in your state, costs almost 30% more than tuition for a 4-year public college in the Tar Heel State. And let me add, since minimum wage in North Carolina is still only $7.25 per hour, a minimum wage worker in North Carolina would have to work full time from January to August just to pay for childcare for one infant.
To work from January to August full time just to pay for the childcare?
Just to pay for one infant. And don't get me started on Washington, D.C., where I live, because the average annual infant cost here in the district is more than $24,000 a year. Now, that's literally 4 times as expensive as tuition at a public university. But also, Melissa, let me add, since 2008, D.C. has pioneered one of the country's most successful universal pre-K programs, and it makes it free for all district residents. So, you know, when my daughter turns 3, we good. But until then, the cost is a lot until 3 years old.
That's a long time. And, you know, it's worth pointing out here that this cost of childcare is not just a problem. Based on those numbers you just gave us, Dorian, it is a full scale catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
And as Akilah talked with us, she was exceedingly clear about how this cost burden of childcare affects real people.
There have been times when I could not afford childcare. And, you know, I've been married for almost 8 years. We both have always had good jobs. And I think the most we spent in 1 year for three of our children to go to daycare was about close to $20,000. That year I made $55,000. So that's, you know, almost half of my income. So I was paying to go to work.
When Akilah Montekine there of Mothering Justice talks about paying to go to work, I mean, she really gets to the heart of at least this one issue we've been talking about so far, the cost of childcare. But I don't want us to forget, Dorian, that the pandemic also made something else brutally clear, and that's the availability of care. And with most schools in most districts around the country closed during the 2020-2021 school year, we were reminded of something else, and it's something that Karen D'Souza, who's a senior writer at EdSource, emphasized when we spoke with her.
In some ways, it's a little bit of a false dichotomy. I think something we learned during the pandemic, I mean, my daughter was 10 for most of the pandemic, but not having her in school, I realized school is also childcare. That is actually how she is minded for most of the day. And when school isn't around, you know, suddenly you need more, you need childcare.
That's right. So we've been talking about the expense of infant and preschool care, but we have to remember that school, Melissa, is childcare. And as you point out, school was mostly closed all of last year. And as a result, nearly 3 million women left the workforce and nearly 2 million still have not returned. We know that women's workforce participation is at a 30-year low.
You know, Dorian, being in media, I've been thinking a lot about the fact that all the headline-grabbing stories are all about this vocal minority of parents who resist vaccinations and they oppose basic safety measures like masking. But the truth is that storyline also lets us ignore that the majority of parents are terrified about their kids getting infected and getting sick. So I absolutely understand why a lot of parents of young children are simply unwilling to risk exposing their kids to crowded classrooms in poorly ventilated schools or childcare settings.
And remember, Melissa, the pandemic exacerbated problems with childcare availability that already existed. So for instance, research by the Center for American Progress showed that in 2018, more than half of families with young children already lived in the childcare desert.
Wait, what's a childcare desert?
Well, you've probably heard of food deserts, but a childcare desert is a measure based on comparing the number of licensed childcare centers and their capacity to the number of young children in a local community. So a childcare desert is actually a census tract where there are more than 3 kids under 5 years old for every 1 licensed childcare slot.
I just bet there are some pretty predictable patterns about which families have access to care and which families are trapped in those deserts.
Mm-hmm. We know that women of color and their children are disproportionately impacted by this problem. And childcare in this country isn't simple, easy, or inexpensive for anyone. This is truly an all of us problem. So here again is Karen D'Souza, senior writer for EdSource.
I think it's a matter of how you define childcare. There are definitely countries in which childcare is defined as a public good, you know, like the parks and the libraries and clean air. It's something that should be state funded so that we all have access to it. In America, it's been largely a private matter, and it is hugely unaffordable for many families.
Okay, let me make this a little more concrete, Melissa. So I went back into the digital archives of the organization I lead. I went digging in the crates at Community Change, and I found a video we produced with parents, with caregivers, and with organizers. And we brought these voices together back in 2018, right? This is 3 years ago. And I think if you listen, you'll hear all these same concerns expressed.
I have 3 children, a 21-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 5-year-old. And I work probably about 45 minutes from home. So right now we are working and juggling a lot of activities.
I was on the waiting list for subsidized childcare for 6.5 years. My son, who is 23, was staying home and watching my kids. He had to put off going to college.
My youngest child has a developmental disability. I have an education that I couldn't use because I was trapped. It's because someone else decided that my child was too much to have in childcare.
I think we should turn to a third critical dimension of childcare, quality.
Absolutely, Melissa, because we know that high quality childcare and early learning for young kids does more than allow parents to earn an income. High quality early childhood education builds the cognitive and social skills of children. And to learn more about this, we talked with an early learning expert.
My name is Karen D'Souza. I'm a senior writer at EdSource.
Now, Karen talked with us about some of the key ways that early childhood education affects learning and development.
It's actually really fascinating stuff. There was a study recently out of Brown about kind of a dire study, actually, about baby IQ during the pandemic. And there were some really huge drops, like 20-point drops. And they said, you know, they're theorizing what it mostly is a lack of kind of serve and return between babies and caregivers. Now, that's how you actually build, you know, the neural infrastructure of the brain. The baby makes a noise, looks at something, reaches out, and the adult responds. And in that interaction, the child learns something about the world and communication and psychology. I mean, things that you don't put into words, certainly not trigonometry, but those interactions build the brain in really crucial ways. And 90% of that happens before kindergarten. So that quality of interaction with the adults in your life, be it your parents, your caregivers, your teachers, is really crucial to like the kind of brain you're going to walk into school with.
And you know, Dora, I know you're parenting a little one right now. And just thinking about that serve and return language that Karen gave us and how many times in a day you do that, it gives us such a clear understanding of the value of early childhood education. And so I asked Karen, because I was wondering, all right, do we have an equally clear and uncontested set of measures about what makes any given childcare setting a quality care setting?
That is an excellent question. I mean, there are many different ways to define childcare. The National Institute for Early Education Research has some metrics that they use, some of it being like the preparedness of the teachers, small class ratios between students and teachers. But there are other people who would define high quality childcare as joyful childcare in which the children really feel responded to and cared for and loved. And so I think it kind of depends who you talk to as to how you define quality.
Joyful childcare. So Melissa, listen, this is not a mystery. We know a lot about what it means to provide true high quality care to young children. And you know, this includes a range of things, a range of metrics, a range of measures, small class sizes with highly skilled staff and teachers, or a language rich environment where children are allowed and encouraged to talk and to sing and to play and interact and not simply told to be quiet and sit still. Another one is, you know, we know kids need stimulating age appropriate activities that allow them to stretch and to think. And we know that it's so important that these environments be clean, be safe, be healthy, and be welcoming.
And Dora, I feel like you heard the same thing I did there from Karen, that language about joyful and that quality being about these joyful, meaningful interactions between children and caregivers. And I know for me, the moment she said it, I was thinking about the Children's Defense Fund Freedom Schools. And for the most part, these schools, you know, they don't operate on a full school year basis. They're mostly summer programs or after school programs, but they really focus in not only on like the key academic skills around literacy, but they are so intentional about constructing this meaningful sense of efficacy and pride and explicitly teaching kids that they can make a difference in their families, in their schools, their communities, their country, their world. I'm an advocate because I did help to establish a freedom school for young learners at Wake Forest University. And I have to say, every day that I would go, it was transformative for me, for the other young people who were serving as caregivers, and for the kids. But it also left me wondering, Dorian, why is it so hard to find these kinds of joyful and rigorous programs, especially for low-income Black, Latinx, and immigrant communities that are served by Freedom Schools?
This is a crucial question, Melissa. So let's go there, because it is so important to retain and even improve the quality of childcare even as we seek to address both the cost challenges and the availability challenges. But there's at least one other important factor that comes to mind, and that's, of course, the low wages earned by childcare workers themselves. And even though childcare is very expensive for each individual family, the people who provide the nation's childcare earn very little. And in fact, many can't afford childcare themselves. Karen D'Souza spoke with us about this issue as well.
I think probably the sort of chasms in the market have to be addressed. Janet Yellen actually recently described childcare in America as a broken market. And I think that's helpful to think about it that way. I mean, nearly half of childcare workers are on some form of public assistance. It's actually one of the lowest paying jobs in the country. And that's why you see so many childcare workers leaving the field, despite the fact that they love what they do and they love small children. Uniformly, anyone I've ever interviewed, you can tell they love what they do. But they have to make more money to feed their own families. So they often take another job at Walmart or McDonald's or Starbucks, which in many cases pays more than their childcare job. So I think until that part, the compensation part, is directly addressed, I think we're going to be grappling with a shortage for a long time.
I want to turn a little bit more on this question of childcare from this slightly different angle of childcare providers.
So important, the providers, because of course, many of the challenges and inequities experienced by families are in fact mirrored in the experience of providers themselves. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, women are 93% of childcare workers, and nearly half are Black, Asian American, or Latinx. Now, many of these women of color childcare workers are the primary breadwinners in their families, but childcare workers earn on average less than $12 an hour. Here again is Akila Muntakim, Deputy Director of Mothering Justice.
I always say that when you are in the care field, when you don't get paid well, you're not really happy. And in order to provide quality care to someone, you need to be happy. You can't be the person there with the attitude because you're watching someone's children and you're realizing that your lights have been cut off and you aren't going to make enough money to have them cut back on. Or you're a child care provider who also has children. You can't bring your children to work with you, even though you're watching other people's children. And you also can't afford to send your children somewhere. So it's this big circle of mess, essentially, right? So the investment not only helps families, it helps the workers and their families, because they do deserve more money. As we're exploring the Michigan License Exempt Provider Program, we're really trying to take a deep dive into what we call other mothers and informal care. But the max pay for a Michigan License Exempt informal provider is $3 per hour from the state. And the lowest amount is $1.75.
Okay, so you heard me gasp there, because for those of you who don't know about this program, I just want to explain it a bit. Now, most states have a program for what are called license-exempt providers. And in a more colloquial language, these are the friends, the family, the neighbors who provide care, and mostly folks who are providing home-based, loving care for someone who's already in their social network. But they're not fully licensed child care centers. But even without that, they are absolutely critical in this kind of patchwork quilt of childcare in our country. These friends and families and neighbors do a lot of loving labor, and it makes it possible for parents to work or to pick up their other kids from school or to grocery shop or, you know, just conduct life. But as Akila pointed out, the current state reimbursement rate for this care is way below minimum wage.
And this program is meant to help families, right? It's supposed to be something that families who cannot afford to go to a home-based center or to a large center, they're looking for this program to help them afford to pay for a friend, a family member, or a neighbor to watch their children. But 9 times out of 10, they're not able to pay them a living wage, and $3 is not going to cut it. These folks also have to pay for their own training and fingerprinting out of pocket. So you have to pay to work and get the funding. But then when you get it, it's literally pennies.
Oh, Melissa, now I'm getting angry, because all of this has me asking the question, why? Why, when we know there is an overwhelming unmet need for childcare? Why, when we know about critical brain development in the years of early childhood, or why, when we know children need joyful, fully engaged childcare providers. Why don't we even pay these workers a living wage? Why is it the case that a worker at Starbucks serving coffee gets paid more than a worker providing joyful, stimulating care for our kids? Why?
93% of childcare workers are women, and about half are Black, Asian American, or Latinx. And I gotta say, when I think about why, I suspect that those demographics are actually part of why. And that if we sort of walk back in the history of who is supposed to be taking care of kids, we assume that it is just the natural outgrowth of women's work, that women are meant to do this work, that they primarily do it in a domestic sphere. And if they're not doing it in their own house, then they are women of color doing it in the houses of white women. And therefore, who needs to pay those kinds of people a living wage?
Yeah, it's all of that. You know, when you go, I mean, how much time do we have? Can we go back to 1619 and start there? Just in terms of the it's not a coincidence. The devaluation of care labor is fundamentally linked to who has historically performed that labor. And of course, it was Black women for a couple centuries who did it without pay. And now, as we know, half of childcare workers are women of color. So to me, it's pretty obvious when it comes to gender, when it comes to race, when it comes to class, how we've historically devalued the work of women of color and the care labor, the valuable, super important care labor for young infants and kids in this country. And as we were talking about before the break, like it just makes no sense that one can get a job for $15 an hour serving coffee, you know, no disrespect to coffee shops, but for the valuable care of infant, when we know 0 to 5 are the most important years from brain development, we have chosen to devalue that labor. And we've tossed it off as an individual problem, not as a collective problem, when we know that care is a collective act.
And, you know, I just want to do one more beat on that, Dorian, because I do run into that so much. As you well know, I am a total, like, advocate crazy lady around diapers and diaper need in this country, and how diaper need shows us so many other things. And usually, like, diapers are a pretty bipartisan issue. They're pretty non-ideological, right? You know, you talk to people about diapers, they get why people need them. But it's not that rare for me to run into folks across the ideological and partisan spectrum who will simply say, look, that is the problem of families. Like, you shouldn't have kids if you couldn't have cared for them. You shouldn't have kids if you can't put diapers on them. And we have this kind of private right of ownership about children, rather than a sense of, again, childhood, rearing the next generation. I couldn't do it without my neighbors who are sweet and kind to my kids and don't poison them on Halloween, and you know, the intergenerational piece and the schools that we go to. You know, I smile at kids when I see them in the elevators, because it feels to me not like I own your kids, to be clear, but like I care about what happens in their lives. And I'd like to be the kind of citizen, the kind of neighbor, the kind of contributor who makes sure that it's not just my kids who are okay, but all of our kids.
I mean, it's one of the themes of the deep dives we've been doing, Melissa, and that is the theme of linked fate. And do we see our fates somehow linked to those kids that might not be our own, but are still collectively our kids? And you asked the question, are the kids all right? That is the fundamental question we should always be asking. And we have to take collective policy approaches to these collective problems. These are not individual problems. And, you know, there are a whole bunch of folks that have nannies and housekeepers, and they don't have a problem with other people changing their kids' diapers. They almost feel entitled to it. And so what would it be to imagine a different kind of system where we grounded the value of collective care and well-being of all of our children? That is the future I want to imagine on childcare and early learning.
Dorian, in our partnership, I like to think of you as like the solutions guy. So let's hear it. What is currently on the agenda for addressing these issues?
Well, listen, last week, President Biden stumped on behalf of the Human Infrastructure Bill, which is frankly the centerpiece of his Build Back Better plan. And he was speaking at the Capital Child Development Center in Hartford, Connecticut. And Melissa, I thought it was interesting that he made this issue so personal through a series of reflections on the difficult time that he had as a single parent. We all know the story, you know, the tragic death of his wife in a 1972 car accident. And the president said this.
I thought, well, I'll get some help. And I was making a decent salary as a U.S. Senator, $42,000 a year. That was a decent salary. And I could not afford the child care. Everybody wonders why I commuted every day 265 miles a day to be back and forth with my children. I could afford the train, was cheaper, to be able to take every day so I could kiss my boys.
But this is not just about a personal connection to the issue. The Build Back Better package has real policy interventions, Melissa. So we asked Karen D'Souza, writer at EdSource, about the potential efficacy of these proposed interventions.
It could make a tremendous difference. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about it is that it is incredibly comprehensive. There's so much in that social safety net package, you know, from an expansion of Medicare to climate change regulations, to a lot of the really crucial early childhood tenets. One of the things that's already happened is the child care credit. Many Americans are already receiving that. A part of the Biden reconciliation plan would make that permanent so that every family, anyone with small children, would permanently be receiving an allowance to help take care of those kids. There's also universal preschool. I believe they're going for 3 and 4 year olds at this point, so that there would be access to preschool for all American children. And there's one more thing. It's affordable childcare. So it would basically cap the amount of money that a family would have to pay at about 7%, which is what many advocates and experts think is a good cutoff for how much you should have to pay towards childcare. And it would also raise the amount of money a childcare worker makes per hour.
Listen, this all sounds great, but I got to say, the only thing more broken than our childcare system probably is like our federal legislature, and specifically the Senate. Still may need to come back around to talk about that in a deep dive. But as a result, no matter how good it sounds, I just had to ask Karen, is there any real chance of these proposals becoming law?
That's the rub. It's an interesting moment we're in, because sometimes out of a crisis is when radical change can happen. You know, Social Security probably wouldn't have happened in America if we hadn't just had the Great Depression, right? So there's a lot of hope that now is the moment. On the other hand, it's a huge spending package and there's a lot of pushback. So I think many experts think that the plan's going to have to be cut down. But in many ways, it is a Sophie's choice. All of these parts of that take care of the whole child and the whole family really work together as an integrated whole. So it's going to make a big difference if some of those things get thrown under the bus, or if everything gets pared back to the extent that it doesn't really make a substantive difference. We'll kind of have to see how it goes.
Karen described the national crisis of our childcare system, or lack thereof, that initiated passage of many of the most powerful programs in our national social safety net. But, you know, there's a long history to the childcare movement, and it goes back to World War II, where mothers were organizing across race around the necessity of having childcare, and especially, as we know, women started entering the workforce in big numbers during World War II. And it led, there was organizing in the 50s and 60s, and it got almost to a point in 1971 of legislation that would have created a national childcare system. And I just have to remind listeners, in case you didn't know, then President Nixon, with a huge assist from his speechwriter Pat Buchanan, vetoed that legislation. He killed that legislation. And here we are, 50 years later, literally 50 years later, talking about the necessity of a high quality, affordable childcare system for the first time in this country. And this is the moment where we'll see if we make a down payment on that system that we so desperately need.
This is not a new problem. We have a history of at least working to try to solve it. And I guess there's this question of whether or not we truly can. So I think it'd be nice if we kind of leave out of our deep dive here with the words of Akilah Montekin, this vision, a freedom dream, what it could look like if we did take a more collective approach to addressing this issue.
we should be reaching out to support one another, you know? And I really think that if we changed our mindset, the world would be, you know, I know it sounds corny, but the world would be a better place. You know, me and my family, we live in a multi-generational home. That allows us to do a lot of things that we wouldn't be able to do if all four adults that are here were paying their own rent or mortgage somewhere. It allows us to support my mom as she ages. It allows us to lean on one another when we need it. And those who have more are able to help the folks who are struggling a little bit, and vice versa. And if we could have that type of mentality as a society, then it wouldn't be so hard for some folks and easier for others.
That was Akilah Montekin, Michigan Deputy Director for Mothering Justice. And we just want to say thank you to all of the voices in this deep dive, including yours. And Dorian, thank you so much for the time, my friend.
Thanks so much, Melissa. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Hi, this is Kathleen from Brooklyn. Last year, I didn't work because of childcare issues. My child was 10 years old and learning remotely and has learning disabilities, so he wasn't able to work independently for school. This was a huge difficulty for me as a single parent. I don't live anywhere with family support, and last year almost broke me.
Hi, this is Lisa from Morris County, New Jersey. I have an 8-year-old in an elementary school that currently has a before and after school program. What we used to pay for the entire month is now what we are expected to pay weekly. This significant change in cost has caused me to have to stay home and not return to my office for my job, which I hope doesn't become a problem for my job too.
Hi, this is Omar from Fort Lauderdale. I have sacrificed a lot as a parent just because during COVID, I didn't even want a babysitter at home, getting the children at risk. They're under the age of 7, so they can't even get vaccines yet. But my wife and I, we did get vaccinated. So we've had a lot of date nights just at home, watching movies on TV or on our smart tablets. And that sacrifice we have made during the pandemic of not getting a babysitter.
Hi, this is Jan from Grapevine, Texas. I have cut my lifestyle in half to provide childcare for my grandchildren so that their divorced father could work. It has been a struggle on many levels, but worth it to secure the well-being of my grandchildren.
Hi, this is Susan from Salem, Oregon. I'm a CASA, court-appointed special advocate. I'm a volunteer working with kids in foster care. This year has been tough because there are fewer eyes on kids. Without mandatory reporting from people like teachers or coaches, it's tougher for me as a CASA to visit some of the foster homes where the kids are. And it's tougher to do tracing because of confidentiality rules.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to comment on any story or give us your thoughts on any topic. Also, we're on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway. Let us know what you think, and thanks for listening.
Now, we've spent much of this hour addressing issues of childcare, and we want to take a look at a very specific and tragic aspect of our national reality. COVID-19 has claimed the lives of more than 700,000 Americans, and among those losses are the primary caregivers of more than 175,000 children. This is the shadow pandemic, and these so-called COVID orphans are at risk financially, academically, and emotionally. We talked with Janelle Alicia, who's a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News.
losing a primary caregiver, a parent or a grandparent at any time in a child's life is traumatic. We know that from a huge body of research that there's higher risks of substance abuse, mental health problems, poor performance in school, lower employment, even, you know, earlier risk of death. Losing a parent during a pandemic brings with it all of the risks of the pandemic, as well as this loss, and as well as the kind of lack of services for these kids that we're seeing because of the pandemic.
So talk to me about this lack of services. Why would there be fewer services for these young people in particular?
Many of the services for these kids are nonprofit centers that focus on grief and bereavement. And when I talked to them a little bit earlier this year, many of them had suspended, of course, in-person gatherings. You know, the kids are primarily unvaccinated. They had tried to do kind of online groups, Zoom groups, and sometimes that worked and sometimes it didn't. They had less staff. So the waiting list got longer, the need grew, and they didn't have the people who could match the need. And I don't see any sign that that has improved yet.
I'm wondering if we have other examples of disaster where we've seen this kind of massive loss for children relative to their caregivers and providers. You know, maybe it wasn't a pandemic, but are there other American experiences of disaster where we've seen so many children lose their adult?
I mean, in the U.S., one kind of discrete example we have is the terror attacks of 9/11. In about 3,000 kids that we know of lost parents or caregivers in that attack. But, you know, the response to them was really different than the response that we've seen so far. There was a federal response. There was massive public fundraising, a lot more galvanized response for that specific event than there has been so far for these kids who have lost parents and caregivers to COVID.
Why do you think that is? Is it because with 9/11, we had a situation where it was so concentrated in one city or really sort of two sort of geographic locations we knew we could identify? And in this case, even though there are tens of thousands, they're dispersed across the country?
Yeah, I really do think that's it. And like, you know, this pandemic has been this slow rolling disaster for these families. One researcher I talked to called the loss of these caregivers for kids a shadow pandemic. And it has happened over this period of time, these past 2 years, and it has happened all over the country, in cities, in rural spaces. And, you know, for one kid, the loss of a parent is a tragedy in that life, but the response of a community is dispersed over time and geography.
Are these kids more likely, just as the pandemic has hit some racial communities with greater loss, the elderly, you know, obviously much greater loss, but do we see the same patterns of African-American, Latino children, and particularly indigenous communities, having lost more parents and caregivers?
Yeah, you know, one of the most sobering aspects of this is that 65% of all the children who have experienced COVID orphanhood or death of their primary caregiver have been kids who are racial or ethnic minorities. So, you know, we know that COVID has disproportionately affected those communities in terms of serious illness and death, and it has disproportionately affected these kids as well.
So just as we always try to both shine light on the problems, but also begin to think through solutions, you know, you pointed, for example, to global disasters, also to the question of the 9/11 losses. Are there things that we can learn about what kinds of support systems need to be in place, what kinds of public policies maybe even need to be in place to address this shadow pandemic?
Yeah, I think so. I know that the researchers that I've talked to who have worked on child bereavement for a long time certainly want more attention, more funding, more recognition that these are significant events that not only pose risks for these kids, but for the larger society. When you have this cohort, this many children who are going to be harmed in this way, we need to look at the problem and target the effects of bereavement. I mean, the Biden administration so far has spent more than $1 billion helping to pay for the funeral costs of families who've lost loved ones to COVID, but no specific action so far about how we're going to deal with the long-term effects of bereavement in these kids.
I'm wondering about how those of us who are parents and caregivers ought to be talking with our own children and or planning. I have to say, once we got to a point where both my husband and I were fully vaccinated and our parents were fully vaccinated and boosted and all of that, I think we stopped having these conversations. I'm wondering if there's a way that we can kind of take this horror, but also use it as parents and caregivers to do better planning or to face some of what's hard.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think for parents of young kids all the way up to teenagers, it's a good idea to talk about it. Talk about what would happen. Talk about things like, you know, for many of these families that I spoke with, when the primary caregiver died, they lost their health insurance. They lose their income, they lose their health insurance. Many of these kids are eligible for Social Security benefits if their parent worked within the system. And only about half of the kids who are eligible actually receive it. And that could go a long way, you know, economically to helping these families. But I think it kind of behooves all of us to think, what would happen? Do I have a plan? Can I even talk about it with other people in my family about, you know, what would happen to my kids? You know, you don't want to kind of dwell in fear, but I think it makes sense to at least think about it since we see that it's happening everywhere around us.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you so much for joining us to really try to think through both the challenging circumstances for these young people, as well as how all of us have to acknowledge we continue to live in both a pandemic and now a shadow pandemic. Janelle Alicia is a senior correspondent at Kaiser Health News. Janelle, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, that's all we have for y'all today. Call us with your show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a voice recording at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, your new permanent host and managing editor. And this is The Takeaway. Meet me back here tomorrow.